A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the kind of question that sounds simple until you actually sit with it. If the UN has no army, no police force, no real mechanism to enforce anything by force, then what are countries actually fighting for when they campaign for a Security Council seat? What does veto power actually protect? What does membership on this council give you that a seat in the General Assembly doesn't?
It's the ultimate velvet rope. The most exclusive club in international diplomacy, 15 members out of 193 countries, and it doesn't even have a bouncer.
No bouncer, no muscle, no ability to throw anyone out. And yet countries spend billions in diplomatic capital, foreign aid, and campaign promises just to sit at that table for 2 years. Japan drops about $40 million a year into the UN budget, and a big part of what it's buying is the argument that it deserves a permanent seat.
That's the paradox we need to unpack. The Security Council can't deploy troops, it can't arrest anyone, it can't enforce its own resolutions. Chapter 7 of the Charter authorizes enforcement action, but Article 27, Paragraph 3 requires all 5 permanent members to agree on anything substantive, so any one of them can block enforcement.
Which means the Council is structurally incapable of enforcing anything against a permanent member or any of its friends. That's not a bug, it was the design. The UN was built to prevent another world war, not to police the world.
The founders weren't naive. They'd just watched the League of Nations collapse because great powers could simply walk out. So they built a system where the great powers had to be inside the tent and gave them a lock on the door.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question. If the lock only works in one direction, if the council can't compel the powerful, then what's the point of holding the key?
I think the answer falls into 3 buckets: procedural control, legitimacy signaling, and informal influence. And the first one, procedural control, is where the real machinery lives. It's not about what the council does. It's about what it prevents from ever happening.
The power to stop things before they start. That's the shadow veto.
It's enormous. Most people think veto power is about dramatic moments. The raised hand in the chamber, the headline about Russia blocking another Syria resolution. But the real work happens in the weeks before any vote. Resolutions get watered down, paragraphs get stripped out, entire agenda items never make it to the table because a P5 member has made it clear, quietly, that they'll veto.
The pocket veto. You don't even have to use it. The threat is enough.
The numbers back this up. Russia has used its formal veto 143 times since the UN's founding. The United States, 83 times. China, only 14 times since 1971. But those are just the visible vetoes. The invisible ones. The resolutions that were never drafted, the debates that never happened, are uncountable.
China's number is especially revealing. 14 vetoes in over 50 years. That's not restraint. That's effectiveness. They don't need to veto things because everyone already knows what they'll block.
The agenda never gets to the point where China has to say no publicly. That's procedural control in its purest form.
Let's walk through what that actually looks like. Russia has cast 17 vetoes on Syria-related resolutions since 2011.
Each one of those vetoes didn't just block a resolution. It shaped the entire diplomatic conversation. The Council couldn't authorize humanitarian corridors that Russia didn't approve of. It couldn't impose sanctions on Syrian officials tied to chemical weapons attacks. It couldn't refer the situation to the International Criminal Court. Every option that required Council approval was dead before it was born.
The General Assembly couldn't fill the gap. The Assembly can pass resolutions condemning anything it wants, and it has, repeatedly, on Syria. But those resolutions have no binding force. The Security Council is the only UN body that can make international law that member states are legally obligated to follow.
Under Article 25, yes, the General Assembly can recommend. The Security Council can decide.
The veto isn't just about blocking action. It's about controlling what counts as international law in the first place.
That brings us to something most coverage misses. The Security Council doesn't just pass or block resolutions. It defines what constitutes a threat to international peace and security. That phrase, threat to international peace and security, appears in Article 39, and it's the trigger for everything the Council can do. Sanctions, peacekeeping missions, military authorization, all of it flows from that determination.
The Council gets to decide what counts as a crisis worth addressing.
That's not a neutral judgment. The Council has authorized 31 peacekeeping operations in Africa since the 1990s. It's been far more reluctant to authorize robust missions in Eastern Europe or East Asia. Not because there's less conflict in those regions, but because the conflicts there touch permanent members' interests.
The cartel decides which fires get the fire department.
That's the phrase. The Security Council is less a law enforcement body and more a cartel that controls the narrative of what counts as a crisis. And membership in that cartel means you get a vote on what the world pays attention to.
Let's start there. The ability to shape the agenda, block resolutions, and define what counts as a threat. That's the first bucket.
Within that bucket, there's a sub-mechanism that even most foreign policy professionals don't think about, sanctions committees. These subsidiary bodies decide which individuals get their assets frozen, which entities get blacklisted, which ships get intercepted.
Who chairs these committees?
The United States chairs the Committee on North Korea Sanctions. The UK has chaired the Committee on Somalia. France has chaired the Committee on the Central African Republic. These chairmanships give the P5 unilateral control over the day-to-day implementation of sanctions.
Even if a sanctions regime gets passed over your objections, which is rare, but possible if you abstain rather than veto, you can still control how it's enforced.
The Libyan sanctions regime in the 1990s is a textbook example. The US and UK controlled the committee that determined which Libyan assets were frozen. They decided what counted as a violation. They decided when to tighten and when to loosen. Gaddafi eventually surrendered the Lockerbie suspects and dismantled his weapons program, and a big part of that was the sustained, committee-level pressure that the US and UK maintained for over a decade.
The committee structure is a force multiplier. You don't need troops if you can freeze assets and control access to the global financial system.
That's where the veto really bites. It's not just about stopping resolutions. It's about preventing the Council from legitimizing action against you or your allies. If you're a permanent member, the Council can never authorize force against you. It can never impose sanctions on you. It can never refer your leaders to the International Criminal Court. Your sovereignty is immunized.
Which explains why Russia and China care so much about their seats. It's not about projecting power. It's about building a shield.
A shield with offensive capabilities. Because while you're protected from Council action, your adversaries are not. The United States can push for sanctions on Iran and North Korea. Russia can block resolutions on Syria, but support resolutions on Libya when it suits them. China can protect Myanmar from Council scrutiny while allowing resolutions on South Sudan to move forward.
The cartel protects its own and selectively squeezes everyone else.
The selectivity is the point. It's not a failure of the system. It's the system working exactly as designed.
Let me push on something, though. The pocket veto is powerful, but it's also invisible. How do we know it's actually happening? How do we distinguish between China quietly blocked this and nobody thought to propose it in the first place?
That's a fair question, and it's hard to prove a negative. But we have enough diplomatic memoirs, leaked cables, and academic studies to see the pattern. When former ambassadors write about their time on the Council, they describe the informal consultations, the so-called informal informals, where the real decisions get made. These are closed-door meetings with no official record, no translation, no public agenda, just the 15 ambassadors and a few aides in a small room.
The smoke-filled back room minus the smoke.
In those rooms, a permanent member's ambassador can say, "Our capital has concerns about this paragraph, and everyone knows what that means. The paragraph dies. It never reaches a vote. The public never sees it."
The transparency is zero, the accountability is zero, and the power is enormous.
That's by design, too. The founders understood that diplomacy works best when it's not conducted in public. But the side effect is that we can only see the tip of the iceberg. The formal vetoes, the rest is underwater.
Which brings us to the elected members. The E10. The 10 non-permanent members who serve 2-year terms. They're in those rooms. They hear the conversations. But they can't block anything.
Yet 60-plus countries compete for those 10 seats every single year. Campaigns run for a decade or more. Countries host summits, offer aid packages, make bilateral deals, all to secure votes in the General Assembly for a 2-year term.
That's the part of Daniel's question that really sticks. If the Council can't enforce anything, and if the elected members can't veto anything, what are they buying?
Pure and simple. An elected seat on the Security Council gets you into those informal informals. You get the intelligence briefings that the P5 share among themselves. You get the back-channel conversations. You learn what the major powers are actually thinking, not what they're saying in public.
It's an intelligence-gathering operation disguised as a diplomatic posting.
But it's also about domestic prestige. For a country like Brazil or India or South Africa, serving on the Security Council is a marker of status. It says, we belong at the top table. It's a signal to domestic audiences, to regional rivals, to international investors.
Japan has served 11 terms as an elected member, more than any other country. And they've been campaigning for a permanent seat for decades. What are they actually buying with that campaign?
They're buying the argument that the current structure is illegitimate. Japan is the second largest financial contributor to the UN regular budget and the third largest contributor to peacekeeping. They're a major democracy, a major economy, a major donor. And they don't have a veto. Germany doesn't have a veto. India doesn't have a veto. Brazil doesn't have a veto. The G4 have been pushing for permanent seats since the early 2000s, and they've been blocked every time.
Blocked by whom?
By different permanent members depending on the candidate. China doesn't want Japan or India at the table. The US has been lukewarm on Brazil. Russia doesn't want Germany. Everyone has a reason to block someone, so the reform never happens.
The cartel protects its monopoly.
The G4 keep campaigning anyway, because even the campaign itself generates diplomatic leverage. Every time Japan raises the issue, it forces the permanent members to explain why the second largest donor doesn't get a vote. That's uncomfortable. That's leverage.
The campaign is itself a form of power. The ask creates pressure.
That connects to the second bucket, legitimacy and signaling. Because a Security Council resolution carries weight that a General Assembly resolution simply doesn't, when the Council speaks, it speaks with the authority of the UN Charter. When the Assembly speaks, it's making a suggestion.
That distinction matters in concrete ways. The 2015 Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, wasn't just a multilateral agreement. It was codified as Security Council Resolution 2231. That gave it binding legal force. Iran wasn't just breaking a deal if it violated the terms. It was violating international law.
That's the halo effect. The Council's seal of approval transforms a political agreement into a legal obligation. And that's why countries want to be in the room when those resolutions are drafted. They want to shape the text. They want to be seen as part of the coalition that made it happen. Even if they can't veto it. Because the vote itself is a signal. When the Council votes 15-0 in favor of a resolution, that's a different signal than 10 in favor with 5 abstentions. The elected members' votes create the appearance of consensus, or the appearance of division. Either way, they're shaping the narrative.
Narrative is power.
In international diplomacy, narrative is most of what there is. The Security Council doesn't have tanks, it has a microphone. And the microphone is connected to a legal framework that every country has agreed to respect.
The tangible benefit of Security Council membership isn't the ability to deploy force. It's the ability to shape what force is considered legitimate.
That's the core of it. The Council's real power is definitional. It decides what counts as self-defense versus aggression. It decides what counts as a humanitarian intervention versus a violation of sovereignty. Those labels matter. They determine whether sanctions get imposed, whether arms embargoes get enforced, whether peacekeepers get deployed.
If you're a permanent member, none of those labels can ever be applied to you.
Or to your allies if you're willing to spend the political capital. Russia has protected Syria. The United States has protected Israel. China has protected Myanmar and North Korea. France has protected its former colonies in Africa. The veto is a patronage network as much as it's a procedural tool.
Permanent membership is essentially an insurance policy. You're protected from the worst the international system can do to you. Sanctions, isolation, legal prosecution, and you gain the ability to extend that protection to your friends.
That's worth far more than any enforcement mechanism. Because enforcement is expensive and risky and politically fraught. Protection is cheap. All it takes is a threat. If you push this, we'll veto. And the push stops.
The lack of enforcement isn't a bug. It's the entire value proposition.
I think that's exactly right. The Security Council isn't valuable because it can enforce things. It's valuable because it can prevent things from being enforced against you.
Which flips the whole conversation on its head. Most people look at the UN and say, it can't do anything, so it's useless. But the permanent members look at the UN and say, it can't do anything to us, so it's perfect.
That's the paradox Daniel's question gets at. The Council's weakness is its strength, depending on where you're sitting. If you're Syria, the Council's inability to act is a tragedy. If you're Russia, it's the whole point.
Let's talk about the third bucket. The stuff that happens outside the formal mechanisms entirely.
This is where it gets fascinating. The Security Council isn't just a decision-making body, it's a social network. The permanent members have been meeting together, in various configurations, for nearly 80 years. Their diplomats know each other. Their intelligence agencies coordinate. Their militaries have back channels. The Council is the institutional home for relationships that extend far beyond the UN building.
The Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance overlaps with three of the five permanent members. The US, the UK, and France is in a separate but related arrangement, so the B3 are sharing intelligence that the other two permanent members aren't privy to.
That creates an asymmetry even within the P5. But the broader point is that the Council provides a venue for coordination that doesn't exist anywhere else. When there's a crisis, a coup, a nuclear test, a cross-border incursion, the permanent members are already talking. They don't have to establish communication. The channels are always open.
Elected members get a temporary pass into that network.
For 2 years, and that's incredibly valuable. During Brazil's 2022 to 2023 term, they gained access to P5 intelligence briefings on North Korea that they simply wouldn't have received as a non-member. They sat in the room while the US and China debated the text of resolutions. They didn't have veto power, but they had information.
What did they do with it?
Brazil couldn't change the final resolution text on North Korea sanctions. But they could use what they learned to inform their own foreign policy, to position themselves in regional negotiations, to signal to their own domestic audience that they were playing at the top level.
It's partly about domestic politics, coming home with proof that you were in the room.
For many elected members, the primary audience isn't the international community. It's their own population. We sat on the Security Council. We voted on matters of war and peace.
That domestic prestige translates into electoral advantage, diplomatic credibility, and sometimes economic benefits. Investors like stability. Being on the Security Council signals that you're a responsible stakeholder in the international system.
It's a certification, like getting an ISO standard for your foreign policy.
Which is why the campaigns are so intense. It's not just about the 2 years. It's about what the 2 years say about you.
The campaigns themselves reshape foreign policy. Countries running for a seat often moderate their positions, increase their aid budgets, and make diplomatic concessions to secure votes. The mere act of campaigning for the Council changes behavior.
The Council shapes behavior even before you join it.
After you leave. Former Council members often continue to coordinate with the P5 on issues they worked on during their term. The relationships persist. The network expands.
The tangible benefits of Security Council membership, if I'm synthesizing this properly, are 1. The ability to block or shape resolutions that would affect you or your allies. 2. The ability to define what counts as a threat to international peace and security, which is the gateway to all enforcement action. 3. Access to the most exclusive diplomatic intelligence, sharing network in the world. 4. The legitimacy halo that comes with the Council's seal of approval. And 5. For non-permanent members, domestic prestige and a temporary seat at the top table.
That's a solid framework. And I'd add a 6th, the ability to shape the rules of global governance beyond the Council itself. Permanent membership on the Security Council is tied to privileges in other international institutions. The P5 are all recognized nuclear weapon states under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They hold permanent seats on the IMF and World Bank executive boards, or at least have disproportionate voting shares. They're all in the G7 or G20 or both.
The council seat isn't isolated. It's the center of a web of institutional privilege.
That web is self-reinforcing. Being on the council gives you leverage in trade negotiations. Leverage in trade negotiations helps you win votes for your next council campaign. The whole thing is a flywheel.
When people say the UN is irrelevant because it can't enforce anything, they're looking at the wrong metric. The UN isn't an enforcement body. It's a legitimacy factory.
The Security Council is the production line. It takes raw political interests and processes them into resolutions, sanctions, peacekeeping mandates, and legal determinations. The output isn't force. The output is permission.
Permission to act, or permission to be left alone.
Depending on who you are. For the powerful, it's a shield. For everyone else, it's a gatekeeper. You want sanctions relief? You need the council. You want peacekeepers? You need the council. You want your territorial claims recognized? You need the council. You need the council.
The gatekeepers charge admission.
In diplomatic capital, in aid commitments, in political alignment. The price varies, but there's always a price.
We've established the procedural control, the legitimacy signaling, and the informal influence. But there's one piece I want to come back to, the elected member paradox. If the permanent members hold all the real cards, why does anyone else bother? You mentioned prestige and access, but is that really worth a decade-long diplomatic campaign?
I think there's a more concrete answer. Elected members can't veto, but they can shape the narrative in ways that matter. During India's 2021 to 2022 term, they used their council platform to advance their counterterrorism agenda. They pushed for listing Pakistan-based militants under the sanctions regime. China blocked the listing of Masood Azhar for years, but India used their time on the council to keep the issue alive, to force debates, to make China's obstruction visible.
They couldn't win the vote, but they could make the obstruction politically costly.
That's a form of power. It's not veto power, it's exposure power. The ability to force permanent members to take uncomfortable public positions.
Sunlight as a weapon.
China eventually dropped its hold on the Azhar listing in 2019, partly because the diplomatic cost of blocking it became too high. India wasn't on the council at that moment, but the groundwork had been laid during their previous term.
The elected seat is partly about gathering ammunition for future fights.
Partly about building the case for permanent membership. Every country that serves an elected term gains experience, builds relationships, and accumulates evidence that they deserve a permanent seat. The G4's argument is essentially, we've served more terms than anyone, we've contributed more money than anyone, and the current arrangement is a relic of 1945.
A relic that the current permanent members have no incentive to change.
Every permanent member would lose relative power if the council expanded. The US doesn't want to share influence with India. China doesn't want Japan at the table. Russia doesn't want a stronger Germany. The math is impossible.
Which is why the reform conversation has been going on for 30 years with zero results.
It'll go on for 30 more. The permanent members will keep holding summits about reform, issuing statements about the need for a more representative council, and then doing absolutely nothing. Because the system works for them.
The summit of the future in 2024 was supposed to address this. The France-Mexico initiative on voluntary veto restraint. The African Union's demand for two permanent seats. Did any of it move the needle?
The summit produced a pact for the future that included language about expanding the council and limiting veto use in cases of mass atrocities. But it's non-binding. The permanent members made supportive noises and then went back to business as usual. The France-Mexico proposal, that the P5 should voluntarily refrain from vetoing resolutions on mass atrocities, has been signed by over 100 countries, but not by the United States, Russia, or China.
It's a suggestion that the people with power have politely ignored.
The diplomatic equivalent of a strongly worded letter.
Which brings us back to the core insight. The tangible benefit of Security Council membership is the ability to ignore strongly worded letters. To be above the fray. To be protected from the very mechanisms you control.
That protection extends beyond the council chamber. If you're a permanent member, no coalition of states is going to impose sanctions on you without risking a council veto that would make their sanctions look illegitimate. No international court is going to indict your leaders without knowing that the council can block the referral. The veto casts a shadow over the entire international system.
It's a deterrence posture, not military deterrence.
It's remarkably effective. The permanent members have faced sanctions, isolation, and legal challenges over the years, but never from the UN system itself. The system is structurally incapable of holding them accountable.
Which means the answer to Daniel's question. What does Security Council membership actually get you is, in one sentence, immunity from the international legal order that you yourself control.
That's the deal. You get to write the rules, enforce them selectively, and never have them applied to you. That's worth far more than an army.
That's immunity. The power to be above the rules you enforce on everyone else. That's the headline benefit. But I want to pull apart the mechanism that actually delivers that immunity, because it's not magic. It's built into the architecture of the Charter itself.
Article 39 gives the Security Council sole authority to determine the existence of any threat to the peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression. The General Assembly can't make that call. The Secretary General can't make it. Only the Council.
Once the Council makes that determination, it unlocks everything else. Sanctions under Article 41. Military action under Article 42. The entire enforcement toolkit.
Which sounds powerful until you hit Article 27, Paragraph 3. Decisions on all non-procedural matters require 9 affirmative votes, including the concurring votes of all 5 permanent members.
That's the word that does all the work. 9 votes total, but all 5 permanent members must say yes. Any one of them says no, and the whole thing collapses.
The UN has no fallback. There is no mechanism to override a veto. No supermajority provision. No emergency exception. The Charter could have included an override. The drafters discussed it at San Francisco in 45, but the great powers wouldn't sign without absolute protection.
The veto isn't a bug in the system. It's the price of admission. The UN exists because the veto exists, not in spite of it.
That's the foundational bargain. The great powers would only join a collective security system that couldn't be used against them. The rest of the world got a forum. The P5 got a shield.
Which brings us to the puzzle Daniel's asking about. If the enforcement machinery is rigged to fail whenever it threatens a permanent member or their allies, what are we actually buying with Security Council membership? What does the veto protect that's worth protecting?
I think the answer breaks into 3 buckets. The first is procedural control, the ability to shape, delay, or kill any resolution before it even reaches a vote. The second is legitimacy signaling, the unique legal and diplomatic weight that comes with a council imprimatur. And the third is informal influence, the intelligence sharing, the back-channel diplomacy, the clubby access that exists entirely outside the formal charter framework.
3 different currencies. And they're all valuable, but none of them look like enforcement. None of them look like what most people imagine the Security Council does.
Most people picture the Council as a kind of global police force. It's not. It's more like a regulatory agency that controls which disputes get investigated, which sanctions get imposed, and which military actions get authorized. It doesn't wield force. It issues permits.
The most powerful permit is the one it never issues. The resolution that never gets drafted because everyone knows Russia will veto it. The sanctions committee that never convenes because China made a phone call. The peacekeeping mission that never deploys because the US decided it wasn't in its interest.
That's the shadow veto. It's uncountable. We can tally formal vetoes. Russia 143, the US 83, China 14 since 1971. But those numbers tell you almost nothing about actual power. The real power is in the resolutions that never exist.
The tangible benefit of membership is partly the ability to prevent things from happening. The power of the door that never opens.
That's hard to measure, which is why it's so often underestimated. People look at the Security Council and see gridlock. They miss that the gridlock is the point. For the permanent members, a paralyzed council is a council that can't act against them.
A council that can't act against you is a council that's working perfectly.
Once you see the council that way, the procedural mechanics get more interesting. The formal veto is actually the failure state. it means the permanent member couldn't get what it wanted through quieter channels.
The veto as admission of diplomatic defeat.
The goal is to never need it, which is why China's only cast 14 vetoes since 1971. That number doesn't mean China is restrained. It means China is effective at shaping the agenda before anything reaches a vote.
The ninja versus the brawler.
Russia's 143 vetoes tell a different story. That's a country that either can't or won't do the quiet work or doesn't care about the optics. But even Russia's formal vetoes are just a visible tip. The real action happens in what diplomats call the informal consultations of the whole.
Which sounds like a euphemism for the meeting before the meeting where the actual decisions get made.
It's exactly that. The council meets in a private chamber. No official record. The permanent members hash out what they can live with, and if one of them can't live with something, it never reaches the formal agenda.
The agenda itself is a product of veto power. Not just the votes, but what's even allowed onto the calendar.
The presidency rotates monthly, which sounds democratic until you realize the permanent members use their presidencies to lock in their priorities and keep uncomfortable topics off the program of work. China held the presidency in August 2022. Guess what wasn't on the agenda? The resolution condemning human rights abuses there had been drafted by Western members. It never got a full council debate because China simply didn't schedule it. When it finally came to a vote under a different presidency, China vetoed it, but the delay itself was a form of power.
The pocket veto. You don't even need to raise your hand, just never put it on the calendar.
That worked for any permanent member. The U.S. has done the same with resolutions critical of Israel. Russia does it with resolutions on Ukraine. The agenda is a weapon, and the permanent members hold it.
What about the subsidiary bodies? The sanctions committees, the counterterrorism committee, the non-proliferation committee? Who controls those?
The permanent members, overwhelmingly. Every major sanctions committee is chaired by a P5 member or their close ally. The Libya Sanctions Committee, the 1267 Committee on Al-Qaeda and ISIS, the North Korea Sanctions Committee, same pattern.
The chair controls the committee's work.
The chair decides which alleged violations get investigated, which individuals get added to the sanctions list, which assets get frozen. In 1994, the Libya sanctions regime gave the committee the power to determine which Libyan assets were frozen and which transactions were permitted. The US and UK controlled that committee. They could exempt their own companies from the sanctions while blocking exemptions for others.
The sanctions regime becomes a tool for selective enforcement. Punish your adversaries, protect your friends, and make sure your own interests aren't touched.
It's all done through procedural motions that never make headlines. A delisting request gets denied. An exemption gets approved. A report gets buried. No veto required, no dramatic vote. Just committee work.
The boring stuff is where the power actually lives.
The flashy Security Council meetings with the name cards and the speeches, that's theater. The real council operates in the subsidiary bodies, in the informal consultations, in the one-on-one calls between permanent representatives. That's where the tangible benefits get distributed.
For a permanent member, the specific procedural advantages over a General Assembly member include: you control the agenda, you chair the key committees, you can kill any resolution before it's drafted, and if something slips through, you can veto it. A General Assembly member gets a microphone and a vote that doesn't bind anyone.
Even the microphone is conditional. The General Assembly can debate anything, but under the Uniting for Peace resolution, it can only recommend. It can't authorize sanctions. It can't authorize force. It can't create binding legal obligations. The Security Council has a monopoly on binding enforcement under Chapter 7.
Which means the permanent members have a monopoly on the monopoly.
They defend it fiercely. In 2022, when Liechtenstein proposed a resolution requiring the permanent members to justify their vetoes before the General Assembly, it passed with overwhelming support. But the resolution doesn't limit the veto. It just requires a meeting. The permanent members show up, give a speech, and the veto stands.
The diplomatic equivalent of, "We have received your feedback and value your input."
Which is all the General Assembly can ever really extract from them. The structural imbalance is baked in at the charter level, and no amount of General Assembly resolutions can amend the charter without Security Council approval.
A body that can't be reformed without the consent of the people who benefit from it, not being reformed.
The circle closes perfectly, And that's not an accident. That's the design.
We've got the procedural toolkit mapped out. Agenda control, committee chairs, pocket veto, formal veto. All of it adding up to the ability to prevent the council from doing anything you don't want it to do. But that's only the negative power. What about the positive side? What can a permanent member actually make the council do?
That's where it gets interesting, because the council can do things that look a lot like governance. It can impose sanctions that every UN member state is legally obligated to enforce. It can refer cases to the International Criminal Court. It can authorize peacekeeping missions with robust mandates. It can recognize new states and governments.
Only if all five permanent members agree.
Which is rare, but when it happens, the result has genuine legal force. And the permanent members compete intensely to shape what that force looks like.
A Security Council resolution doesn't just sit on a shelf. It gets cited in court cases. It gets written into trade agreements. It becomes the legal architecture that other countries build their foreign policies around.
This is the legitimacy bucket, and it's arguably more valuable than the procedural control because it outlasts any single vote. When the Security Council speaks, it speaks with the voice of international law. Chapter 7. Resolutions are binding on all UN member states. That's not a suggestion. That's Article 25 of the Charter.
If you can get a resolution passed, you're not just winning a diplomatic argument. You're writing law.
The permanent members understand this perfectly. Look at the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The JCPOA could have been structured as a simple multilateral agreement between Iran and the P5 plus Germany. Instead, they codified it as Security Council Resolution 2231.
Because a resolution has teeth that a treaty doesn't.
Specifically, it automatically binds all UN member states to enforce its provisions. It triggers sanctions, snapback mechanisms. It creates legal obligations that survive changes in government. If the deal had just been a political agreement, any party could walk away with minimal legal consequence. As a council resolution, walking away means violating international law.
Which is why the Trump administration's withdrawal from the deal in 2018 was so legally awkward. They weren't just leaving an agreement. They were repudiating a binding council resolution they had themselves voted for.
It's why the Biden administration's attempt to re-enter the deal got tangled in procedural knots. Once you elevate something to the Security Council, you can't easily unelevate it. The resolution lives on, and so do the obligations.
The power to create binding international law is itself a tangible benefit. But there's also a softer version of this, the halo effect.
The halo effect is real, and it's not just diplomatic prestige. The permanent five aren't just permanent members of the Council. They're the five recognized nuclear weapon states under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's not a coincidence. The NPT text explicitly names the same five countries. The Security Council seat and the nuclear status are legally intertwined.
The veto literally protects your nuclear arsenal from being declared illegal.
It protects a whole ecosystem of institutional privileges. The P5 have de facto permanent seats on the IMF and...
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.